The rest of this morning's program, pre-Thanksgiving as it is really about the nuts and bolts of Thanksgiving dinner. And we're going to talk to Bonnie and Liz after the CBC Radio News. They're going to talk about whether or not you should have the formal dinner or a buffet or be even more casual and, I don't know, have your dinner in a trailer if you want, if you have to. Whatever. But what else is important about the Thanksgiving dinner? It's the wine. It's the stuff that goes with all those courses. And have we got a panel for you? Conrad Edgebick is the author of A Pocket Guide to Ontario Wines, Wineries, Vineyards, and Vines. And Natalie McLean is the author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over. They are our Sounds Like Canada wine panel this morning. Sounds like I've already had some. Both Conrad and Natalie are in Toronto this morning. Good morning to the two of you.
Hi, Sheila.
Good morning, Sheila.
What have you two been up to since last week? Spoke. Natalie, I gather you've just come back from Germany.
I have. I was there for the harvest. Oh, Conrad's cutting into the stuff here, I should say.
I couldn't hold it back. I'm not waiting.
We're hands-on panel.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So what were you doing?
I was visiting German winemakers in the Moselle, and that's in northern Germany. The vineyards are on a 70-degree incline. They go right down, plunging down into the Moselle River. It feels like if you took one wrong step, you'd be rolling right down to the water. And they make fantastic Riesling. It's on the edge of viticulture, just marvelous, marvelous wines. Great for Thanksgiving turkey.
Natalie, am I right in thinking we don't really understand German wines anymore? I think we all went through our Blue Nun period, or Liebfraumilch, and you know.
Yeah, if we're willing to admit it. Sure. That's the hangover, the nasty hangover image we have from the 1970s of sweet, syrupy wines. But I think Conrad will agree with me that Riesling is one of the best-made white wines today. It's got the fantastic balance between acidity and some degree often of sweetness. And that interplay is what makes it magic with food, especially dry meats like turkey, or at least the way we cook our turkey.
Conrad, what have you been up to since we last spoke?
Oh, I've been drinking a lot of wine, a lot of wine.
I knew you'd say that.
I've been out of the country a couple of times and visiting a lot of wineries in the country, took part in the Canadian Wine Awards. We're going to have some fantastically interesting new wines come out in the spring when those awards are announced. Just plugging away at preserving my liver.
Good. Now, as I said, Bonnie and Liz are going to be talking about whether or not we have a casual or a formal dinner. Do you two have an opinion before we get to them?
Well, at our house, we have sort of a, first of all, we have two dinners, so because we have two families and two extended families. But this time we'll be doing it on a Sunday.
Now, I remember last year you said you were having a salmon for your Thanksgiving dinner.
Yes.
Are you going to stick with the fish?
No, we're doing turkey. We're doing a big turkey. We need a large amount of food. And I like to cook the whole turkey. We do it in the oven, and once it's done, I like to carve it in the kitchen and then bring it out on a big platter.
Okay, well, I'll try to remember that as I talk to Bonnie and Liz. Natalie, what about you? Formal or informal?
Pretty informal. I'm heading to Halifax, which is home for me, and I come from a long line of proud women who can't cook.
But they can drink.
Yeah. You got it.
Perfect.
So we are actually, there's a marvelous catering company in Halifax. We're getting our turkey pre-prepared, but we're going to make the side dishes because we feel we can handle, you know, skinning the carrots and so on, the simple stuff. But what's really going to make up for it are some great wines. And that's how we compensate in our family with really good tasting wines.
Great. Well, I am very lucky to have three bottles standing by me like proud sentinels here. Shall we start?
Mm-hmm. Please.
All right. What shall we begin with? Huh?
Well, I think sparkling wine is always the nicest way to begin.
Absolutely.
I mean, you could have this through the whole meal. You could have it from the beginning to the end, or you could just have it at any point or just at the beginning. It's a lovely aperitif because it's crisp, it's cleansing, it's acidic, it gets your stomach juices flowing. The gas in sparkling wine tends to get you a little more buzzed more quickly, but at the beginning of a big reception with family you haven't seen in a long time, you might want to get there quickly.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
It's not a bad thing, that's for sure. Shall we then dive in? What should we taste?
Sure. Yeah. Well, this one is called it's from Sumac Ridge,
yep.
Beautiful British Columbia winery, first boutique winery in British Columbia, and it's the first Méthode Champenoise sparkling wine produced in Canada by Harry McWaters, and it's called Stellar's Jay.
It's also good to start off the Thanksgiving feast with a toast. I think we don't drink champagne or sparkling wine enough. And so if this is occasion enough, it's a great way to really, you know, bring the family together, stand up and have a toast to just to be thankful that
Absolutely.
We're all around
very,
the table.
Very Absolutely. Nice. Stand up. May we live as long as we love and love as long as we live. Cheers.
That's
gorgeous.
Conrad.
You're here.
Cheers. Okay. Everybody drink. Do you like it?
I love it.
Isn't
that great? It's so refreshing.
It's as good as champagne in quality, although not as complex. It's just a little more straightforward, but it reminds me so much of the Okanagan Valley that covered in apples and fruits. I'm just getting
it is nice and fruity, isn't it?
Yeah, it really does the job.
It's good. And, you know, I love how you describe it, like the Okanagan itself. It's nice and wide and open, too.
Yeah. And do you notice, Sheila, that your mouth is watering?
Yes, I do notice that.
So it's whetting your appetite, literally.
That's too Great bad. Because this is just not going to do me any good at all for another, I don't know, 3 days. But it does have that effect, right, Natalie?
Mm-hmm, it does. And that's what makes it also a good food wine, because you want your mouth to be watering, especially with the drier meat or the side dishes.
And there are a lot of, absolutely, you're right, Natalie, and there are a lot of heavy foods there's not just a lot of food, but a lot of heavy foods. So you want something that's refreshing and cuts through the richness. I was going to say the grease, but really the richness.
Exactly. Those cream sauces or whatever else, the dressings you're putting on your meal.
The extra piece of skin I put on my plate.
So exactly. Could we have this for the whole meal then? Could this just stay put on the table until dessert?
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
Yeah. It's a great idea, Conrad. From start to finish, bubbly will get you through the entire meal.
All right. Good. I have only one more question about sparkling wine, and that is temperature. I was out for dinner the other day and a friend was getting very animated, and his opinion was that the worst thing about wine presentation is that whites are served too cold and reds too warm. But leave aside the reds for a moment, because we'll get to reds in just a sec. But what about the whites? Are they generally too cold?
I think so. I think a lot of that advice goes back to medieval days when times were very different. I mean, you know, we put whites and bubblies in the fridge and you can numb them too much, so that all you get from a really super cold white or bubbly is just the alcohol or the oak. That's what comes forward first. You don't get the lovely fruit aromas that start to emerge as the wine warms up. And so with the reds, too, if they're too warm, you're still going to get too much alcohol. Room temperature means medieval castle room temperature. So we've got to put that in context for our modern times.
You have to recall, remember, Sheila, that fridges are made in this country for beer drinkers. Okay. And beer should be tasted at about 4 degrees centigrade. So your fridge, the cold part of your fridge, is set at about 4, and your freezer at minus 10. But sparkling wine ought to be about 4 or 5 degrees warmer. Imagine having a rose that is blooming. It's starting to open up in the heat, and you put it in the fridge. Well, it's going to stop down right away. It's going to close and just shut itself down. All the smells will leave. So you want it slightly warmer. White wines, again, slightly warmer, and red wines, again, slightly warmer. But in fact, the red wine that we're going to have next, I put in the fridge for 20 minutes before we served it.
Really?
Okay, just to bring it down below room temperature. Ideally, a cool cellar temperature.
Okay, well, then we should move very, very nicely into the red.
Good segue.
Okay, yes. It was really perfect.
Great idea.
Conrad is married to a radio producer. Perhaps that's got something to do with his sense of segue. It's possible. Anyway, what have we got here? Who would like to describe this one?
This is a beautiful Pinot Noir from Le Clos Jardin in Niagara. And I think Conrad and I are both really, really excited about this wine. It's a venture between Vincor and Boisset from France, and they're producing magnificent Pinot Noir. Pinot Noir is something we do really well in Canada, along with the Riesling and the ice wines, because we're a cool climate, much like Germany. And so we're on the edge, which is good for vines, make them suffer. And it produces pinots that are just packed with flavor, but not heavy, not dense. They have this ephemeral kind of balance that's just beautiful. And again, this is a great wine for turkey. It's a juicy red that's going to moisten up that meat.
Mm-hmm. All Pinot Noirs are really great for turkey. And unfortunately, this one you might not be able to have. We're really lucky, because when I requested a sample of this Le Clos Jardin, they were going to send us the one that was currently available, but I didn't realize a couple days ago that it actually sold out. So by By chance, they sent us this 2005 that's going to be released soon. And this is probably, I feel embarrassed saying this, Sheila, but I have to do it. This is the best Pinot Noir made anywhere in the world outside of France.
Would you say that again?
I would. And you know what? I was a little embarrassed about saying this a couple of days ago. I was sitting at dinner with a Chilean trade liaison, and he asked me about Pinot Noir, and I said this, and I felt a little awkward, and I looked over at the person sitting right next to me. It was Tony Asper, also a great Canadian wine writer.
Right.
And Tony nodded his head and said, I have to concur. It's the best Pinot Noir anywhere in the world outside of Burgundy.
I hear... the footsteps marching to microphones all over California.
I hope
saying,
so.
Saying, Conrad Edgebick, are you out of your mind?
Not
it's
at
magnificent.
All. In
really?
Fact, Thomas Batchelder, the winemaker of this wine, took a bunch last year to the IPC, the International Pinot Celebration in Oregon at, I can't remember if it was Dundee or McMinnville. And without any PR, without any bluster, et cetera, they set up their table in one corner. And there were Pinot Noirs from New Zealand, from Oregon, from France, from California, from Australia, from Tasmania, from all the great Pinot producers you can imagine. And Thomas's wine was the first to pour out. There was so much buzz about his wine. And I know why. It's because it goes beyond what most Canadian. Natalie said that Canada makes great Pinot Noir, and in a sense that's true. We've been making it well to a degree, but we haven't been making it well enough. Hmm. We've been making it well enough for Canada, but this wine takes it beyond the for Canada. This is. I'm not going to say it again. It's the greatest.
It is.
Natalie, you concur.
Oh, I do. You know, this wine actually made me feel conflicted as a journalist because I loved it and I didn't want to recommend it because I wouldn't be able to buy it if I did. So I still threw myself on the flames of self-sacrifice and recommended it. It's a hard one, but if you can get your hands on it, it's worth getting a case. I love serving this to friends and saying, look what we can do.
The other thing is that as a Canadian wine journalist, and this is a Canadian wine, I'm always concerned that maybe I'm just a little biased for my own wines. And in fact, I have done it in blind tastings a number of times where I've not known what I'm tasting.
Oh, good.
And it is spectacular.
My bottle here in Vancouver is really funny because it's got two labels. And I peel off the top one that says Le Grand Cru 2004. And underneath, there's another label saying Le Grand Cru 2005.
I was concerned about that too. And I immediately called the wine and I said, what's going on? Are you guys
covering
fiddling
something
with these
up?
Wines or what? What's going on? And it was explained to me that normally what they have is when they're doing a bottling, if they run out of labels, they're gonna still set aside that wine and try to rebottle it later. Or relabel it later. And there was one of these confusions that someone had thought that even though it had the 2005 label on it, it was actually a 2004. But when you remove the capsule at the top, the cork itself is branded. And the cork has the brand on the side, Le Clos Jardin, and on either end, it has the vintage 2005. So you can't fiddle around with this. This is a secure way of sealing your bottle where you brand the cork. The only way of diddling with it is pulling the cork and changing it.
And is 2005 better than 2004?
It's different, okay?
Okay.
It's better in numerous ways. It was a very hot, dry, short vintage, and there's very little grape, and extremely intense, whereas 2004 was a long vintage, a cool vintage, but the grapes were picked late, almost into November at the end of October. So 2004 actually has much higher alcohol, more delicacy in the flavor. It's got a leanness, whereas this has reduced alcohol but has increased flavor because the grapes were so concentrated and balanced. So when I smell this wine, I haven't tasted it. I'm just so excited smelling it.
It just runs out to meet you, doesn't it?
Okay, let's taste. Here we go.
It has smells of cherry blossoms, maraschino cherries.
It's just so aromatic, too. It's just like a cloud that goes around your head.
It's almost candied. Sometimes you open a box of like raspberry candy, a can of, and you put your nose in, and you just get this intense raspberry smell coming. It's just exploding with aromas.
Without the cloying. It's beautiful. And I can see, Natalie, your point about it being a perfect accompaniment to the meal and some the big juicy sort of flavor that it's got.
Yeah, and it would go so well with a lot of other side dishes on the table because it's not just about the bird.
Right, you know, absolutely.
You've got the candied sweet potatoes, the honey dipped carrots or whatever you're doing. So you want the juicy sweetness. Mm-hmm. This is technically a dry wine, but it will taste juicy
and
because
sweet.
Of the ripe fruit.
It's,
yes.
It's so sweet. In fact, you have so many sweet things beside the turkey.
Yes.
Cranberry juice, cranberry sauce, a little bit of this or some kind of chutney or
that's or why Brussels sprouts were invented.
That's right. No, that was to keep the kids in line. But when you smell this wine, I almost get cranberry on. I get
yeah,
all the smells.
That's true.
And Natalie was saying earlier when we were talking about Riesling, right? At the beginning, how wonderfully a sweet wine goes with turkey. This wine is implicitly sweet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not sweet at all, and yet you smell sugar. You smell
right.
It's like again, it's like a rose. You smell a rose, and it smells so sweet.
It
and
does.
You eat the petals, and there's nothing there.
Yeah, and contrast this, if you will, with a dry, big Cabernet that's very tannic. Tannin's that sort of furry mouth feeling you get from oversteeped tea.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that with turkey, and how dry that would taste, and how this wine is so much better for a meal like this.
Here again, Sheila, your mouth is watering. Your mouth is just juicy and watering from this wine. It has high acidity. It cuts through the richness.
Absolutely.
This is like a science fiction experiment. And this is Fantastic Voyage by Isaac Asimov. And Conrad knows what's going on inside my mouth. So does Natalie. It's unbelievable.
I've been there, Sheila. No.
No, you have not. Just let's make that very, very clear.
Only in my wine mind.
Conrad and Natalie. Conrad Edgebick and Natalie McLean are in our Toronto studio. And we're getting ready for the Thanksgiving dinner. Natalie, we have one more wine to explore that sounds a little like a fungus. Botrytis-affected Riesling.
Yes, there are good kinds of rot.
Tell me about this
world.
One.
Yeah, this is from Henry of Pelham, from Niagara, as you mentioned. It's a sweet wine, so you're going to want to serve this with dessert. But what botrytis does is it dehydrates the grapes. So it attacks the grapes and siphons off their water, attacks them and shrivels them. So what you're left with the concentrated essence of the grape flavor and the sugars that are there. So, you know, another way to get sweet wine is through the frozen grapes that we pick in January for our ice wine. This is a different kind of sweetness, but it's still that same rich concentration, luscious mouth texture, coating it, your entire mouth. Great for desserts with Thanksgiving dinner.
Right. Now, botrytis itself can be very positive, but it can also be very negative. It's actually, botrytis is one of the blights of vineyards in that botrytis in normal situation will rot and ruin entire vineyards. It's only when there's a specific combination of climatic conditions where you have a little bit of moisture in the evening, the dew rises, but then the sun comes up quickly, a little bit of dry, warm wind dries off the grapes, and the mold that begins growing on the grapes doesn't grow vigorously and damage the skins of the grapes and enter into and mix with the pulp and taint it, it sends tiny, tiny filaments through the pores of the skin of the grapes. Those filaments will enter and they'll slowly suck out the water. And when they're sucking out the water, they're dehydrating the grapes, just like Natalie said. But in fact, the grapes aren't dehydrated like raisins, which are dried under the sun on straw mats. They're dehydrated in a natural, moist way. So they're still moist. You still have this living mold growing on these, which it wouldn't in a dry sun. Now, when the grapes are fermented, the mold goes into with the wine and also adds a slightly honeyed truffle-like nuance that gives it just sort of tweaks the taste beyond what you would expect from wine. It almost becomes candy or dessert or some other alien liquid that's just an elixir.
Well, botrytis is the perfect name for an alien.
Yeah, it is.
But I guess, Natalie, it sounds a little bit like you, it's tricky, right? You're playing a little bit of botrytis roulette here.
You are, yeah. As Conrad said, there's good and bad. But what we've got in the glass here is definitely good. It's just really making this wine very concentrated. Germany is also famous for botrytis-affected wines. And so, again, we have a lot of similarities with Germany in the wines that we produce.
I was talking a couple of days ago with Paul Speck, who is the producer of this wine, the president of that company. And what they did with this wine is they went through the vineyards about four or five times in the fall, picking out only the botrytis-affected grapes. So they pick not the whole bunch, but just a section of the bunch. They take out the rotting, not the rotting, the part affected by botrytis, and gather that over a period of weeks in order to preserve the rest of the bunches to save them for ice wine. So it's the same grapes, the same Riesling grapes, but some they're going to take and set aside and ferment earlier with the botrytis, but keep the botrytis out of the ice wine. And it's a really interesting match to compare the Henry of Pelham ice wine with the Henry of Pelham botrytis affected Riesling, same vintage. Amazing difference.
Yeah. It's very labor intensive, Sheila, when they do this, because they can go, you know, several passes through the vineyards, again, both here and in Germany. And so you get a very pure wine, because they, as Conrad said, they're not mixing in ripening grapes or other types of grapes. They're just getting this one kind of profile of grape. And so I know in Germany they can pass through the vineyards 7-8 times, just getting the exact ripeness that they want.
Three fabulous wines, and they will all be spelled out on our website, cbc.ca/soundslikecanada. Thank you so much for this. Great to talk with both of you.
Oh, it's great to talk with you, Sheila. Have a great Thanksgiving. Shall we raise our glasses in a coast-to-coast
toast?
Oh,
let's do that.
Okay.
Here we go.
Coast-to-coast.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right.
Cheers. Conrad Edgebick is the author of A Pocket Guide to Ontario Wines, Wineries, Vineyards, and Vines. And Natalie McLean has a newsletter at nataliemclean.com. And she is the author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over. As I said, Bonnie and Liz are ahead after the CBC Radio News.